right. So thanks everybody for tuning in. I am here joined by James Sutter, the creative director. I have that title right?
Yeah, the original creative director.
For Starfinder. James, you were here when the game was first pitched and through its entire development process behind the scenes. You were here all the way through the game's release. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's really great.
Yeah, no problem. And I was there a long time before the game even existed, right? I was there at Paizo before Pathfinder. I was involved in that original creation as well. So yeah, way back to the Dungeon and Dragon days.
Yeah. See, I was lucky enough to work with Chris Carey for about a year.
Oh, okay.
Before he left Paizo.
Yeah, yeah.
So he told many stories about you back when it was like six people in one big room.
Right, right.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. And thank you for correcting me, because yes, you were with Paizo long, long before there was a Starfinder.
Yeah.
So I started at Paizo about a year and a half ago. I started in March of 2019. Okay. You left in December?
It might have been, yeah, it was within like 2 or 3 months of the game's launch. Yeah.
So you were gone by the time I got there. And the first time I met you was when you came back and you were sort of on a reunion tour briefly of the offices. And
yeah, and hi.
And I had a story to tell you. You've probably forgotten it. But when I first bought the Starfinder book, and as I've mentioned on this podcast before, I was basically told to buy the book by Cam Banks, if you know Cam.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been a guest of honor with Cam at a convention before, so we hung out.
So Cam went to Gen Con 2019, and he posted on his Facebook page, Starfinder is the future of RPG design.
Hmm.
You have to buy it. Like, if you're interested in the industry, if you've never played in the world, you have to look at it, because it is the future of RPG design. Well, Cam Banks knows his shit, so I'm
sure.
Him, right? So I bought the game. And then a couple of months later, I got the opportunity to apply for an editor position. But as I was reading the book, I was really struck by the imagination in this project. Between the first page and the last, there were just so many incredible ideas just popping off the page. And I'm an old comics guy, so when I think about imaginative works, I go back to Kirby. I don't know how much Jack Kirby.
Sure, was. Yeah.
But it very much gave me that sort of Kirby feel, where I was just like reading from one page to the next, and there was just all this crazy shit in every paragraph, and like so many ideas that we don't have time to develop, but you will, gentle reader, you know?
Well, that's a big part of my strategy with RPG stuff, and always has been, is I feel like the thing, more often than not, the thing that people are paying you for is the ideas. You know, rules are nice, but, you know, people want inspiration. Like, that's what separates a professional, you know, game product from somebody's homebrew stuff. They're paying you for the inspiration that they can then take and do something else with. I've for a long time said, if you're going to do, you know, I love writing gazetteers and setting material. And I say, you need to have an adventure hook in every paragraph. Like, you need to know, what is the thing here that is going to spark a game or spark a player's imagination? And if you're not giving them that, you're really not doing your job with the setting.
Interesting. Okay, so I asked around about Starfinder, and I got told things about the development of Starfinder, and I want you to tell me if these are true or false. I want you and tell us what really happened. But what I understood was that there was a hole in the development schedule at Paizo, that Pathfinder 2nd edition was just taking longer to get done than we thought it would take. And when I say we, I mean Paizo, even though I was
sure.
Not. And so there was essentially a hole in the development schedule. What are we going to put there? And Starfinder was pitched not as the ongoing RPG that it is now, where it's ever growing on, but rather as a kind of self-contained game that was going to be a core rule book, an Alien Archive monster manual, and one adventure path of 6 volumes. And that was it. That was the entire project. And it was just there to get us through to P2. Is any of that true?
I mean, some of that is true. I think, you know, for me, I will say that I never thought it was going to be just that. I think that was the sort of conservative business case.
Okay.
And I think, so really for most of us, where the thing became a reality was, for many years, there'd been sort of an idea floating around with various people of like, God, wouldn't it be fun to do a science fantasy version of Pathfinder? And, you know, maybe that was going to be an RPG, like one of the just big rule books, like horror adventures, like maybe that'll be Outer Space Adventures, or maybe that'll be, you know, the Big Book of Numeria, like the tech guide for Numeria that Jacobs and folks worked on was sort of also pointing that direction. But, you know, there had been this idea that, like, God, wouldn't it be cool, especially because at that point we'd all been doing Pathfinder for many years at this point. And I think a lot of us who'd been around for a long time were a little bit nostalgic for the days of knowing nothing about the setting and the game. You know, when we were first writing, you know, the first Pathfinder Adventure Path volumes or the first couple of core rule books, there was just so much uncharted territory that it was really exciting for us as creators. And so I think we were all a little bit nostalgic for that. And so really for me, the point at which the game became a reality was when Eric sat us all down in a big meeting and said, hey, I want to do the Starfinder thing. I think we want to do a Starfinder, you know, a science fantasy role-playing game that's standalone. You know, it's based off of Pathfinder, but it's its own thing. And we all, you could just see everybody's eyes light up as we all just went, oh my God, that would be so much fun. Yeah. And then he said, and in order to do it, here's the window when it's going to have to happen, you know, between now and Pathfinder 2, if we're going to actually pull this off with the resources we have. And a number of people just said flatly, like, it couldn't be done.
Yeah.
And we, you know, there was a really hard discussion where we were all excited about it, but a lot of people said, like, it would give us, I think we had 1 year from that meeting to when the book would have to ship. And we're talking a book that was, to be clear, this is a book that was going to be as big as the Pathfinder core rule book, which was the biggest book we'd ever published. Plus, we wanted to have setting material. Plus, we wanted to have starships. Plus. It's like, this is like a 1,000-page book and a new adventure path and, you know, all the creatures we're going to need. And so there were definitely people in that meeting and for months afterwards who said, this is not possible. This cannot be done. It's irresponsible to try. And as I recall, I could be wrong, but we
ask you who those names are, because I'm probably working with them.
some of them are still around. But you know, we thought about it. And as I recall, it was like towards the end of the week when we had that meeting. And I thought about it over the weekend, and it was something that I had always been really passionate about, because I had written a book called Distant Worlds for Pathfinder back in like 2011, something like that.
It's a very early book.
It was a pretty early book, and it was me basically just designing Pathfinder's solar system. We had known very little about it at that point. We had known, I think the only things we'd known is Eric wanted a red and a green planet that were based on sort of pulp Venus and pulp Mars. Yeah. And we knew that Octurn existed as sort of like a Lovecraft planet, because that had been in a very early Pathfinder module. Okay. But other than that, we knew nothing. And so I got the rest of the team to just give me carte blanche to go write a book designing the solar system. And it was sort of, you know, kind of a niche thing that like, Sutter's really into this, he should go do it. And then the book was very popular. Like, people were super into it. And so, you know, I thought about that. I thought about everything that was happening. And I said, then I went back into Eric Mona's office the next week and said, I think we can do this. I think it's going to be incredibly hard, but I think it's doable. And here's how I'll do it. Here's how I would do it. Yeah. And I laid everything out for him, and he said, all right, you're in charge. And that was how I became creative director of Starfinder.
What was your position when you walked into that meeting?
I was executive editor. I had done a bunch of stuff over the years. I'd done editing and development. I'd also launched, you know, with Eric and Chris and other people, the Pathfinder Tales novel line, and had been in charge of that. So I'd done kind of a little bit of everything, which was one of the things that made me the right person, I think, to put in charge of that project. And so we went ahead and did Starfinder, and he put me in charge. And fortunately, everybody was cool with the idea of like, hey, let's take Distant Worlds and make that the basis for the setting. Let's make this, because in the beginning, there'd been some discussion of, well, should this be just totally new? Should we design a totally new setting? And instead, we went with the idea of, let's take the Pathfinder campaign setting. Let's put it forward thousands of years in the future, kind of taking like the Warhammer 40K model. And a lot of the fun will be from seeing how things have carried over, which things are still around, which things aren't. And that'll get Pathfinder players interested in Starfinder. But also, you know, I was really happy with the setting I'd been able to create for Distant Worlds. And we knew that the audience liked it. So it was nice to have something to start from. And we really were able to work from that as the basis of the setting, which was a lot easier than trying to do it whole cloth. And I'm really glad at how it turned out.
What I noticed about it when I went back and I looked at Distant Worlds for the first time, and I looked at like the Lashunta, for example.
Sure.
How they're drastically kind of updated. For the new setting. And in many ways, I see this as part of Starfinder's unique ability in the gaming space to capture diverse audiences and have a kind of progressive voice in the original Lashunta, of course, like the women are all tall, willowy, and they ride, they're nude, and they ride, you know.
Right, yeah.
That's all topless. And that all got cut. And of course, that's a pulp trope. And I totally, like, we're going for that ERB kind of feel, that planetary romance feel.
Well, and Eric and Chris and I had run a line of novels called Planet Stories years, where we republished old pulp novels, because Eric was in love with stuff from, you know, like the 30s and the 40s. So like that was very much the DNA that, like, you know, Eric especially was really a champion of. We got to get that pulp DNA in there. And I mean, Chris Carey is now in charge of the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate. So like he obviously had a lot of that too. But can you
walk me through some of the conversation about, for example, that particular species?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And updated. What were your goals?
I mean, when you say like, oh, that's an example of, you know, diversity and whatnot, I call that an example of learning from our mistakes. Right. You know, I feel like, you know, I've always been pretty open about the fact that, like, look, I started at Paizo when I was 20.
Yes.
Like, I couldn't even drink yet. And like, that's true of a lot of us. I mean, nobody else was quite that young, but like, we were a bunch of, you know, young white dudes living in a young white dude industry and a young white dude area, you know. And so a lot of our early work reflected that. Yeah. And then over the years, as we, you know, hired on a more diverse staff, got taught, you know, and sometimes schooled by a lot of people, you know, and became more aware, it became really important to us to not just keep perpetuating the mistakes of the past. And so, you know, one of the big challenges with trying to figure out the Lashunta was they were a race that, you know, had been very popular, but had a lot of that, you know, practically 100-year-old DNA at this point. And so it was really important for the team to sit down and say, like, okay, how do we make this, how do we take this trope and not just like throw them out all together and say, oh, the, you know, the Lashunta all have, we had a term, and this was actually back from Pathfinder, that we called fire cancer, which you may still hear around the office. Okay. But whenever we needed to, usually when we needed to retcon something, we'd do it elegantly. But every once in a while, there was something where we just went, that's got to go. And then when somebody would say, hey, what happened to this NPC that isn't there anymore? We go, oh, they got fire cancer. Sorry. We didn't want to give the Lashunta fire cancer. So instead, what we did is we took the sort of classic tropes that had been very much straight out of Howard and Burroughs and whatever of, you know, the tall, attractive women and the short, you know, burly dudes. And that sort of sexual dimorphism. And we said, okay, what if the Lashunta are instead what if these are two different sort of subspecies that interbreed? And actually, I remember Crystal Frazier introduced me to the term clade, as you know, these two different branches of the same species, and made it so that actually, you know, one of them is, you know, more strategic and diplomatic, and the other one is a little more sort of warlike and physical and whatnot, but it has nothing to do with gender. It's totally untied. And in fact, you can choose whichever you want to be at puberty, and made it so that it's okay. Well, here's actually, we've got these two different, sort of two for the price of one. But it's no longer this, frankly, pretty offensive gender thing. And also I really liked, something I was quite proud of was the idea of like, there had been this classic, oh, Lashunta are all hot. They're all super attractive. Everybody loves them. Yeah. And so I thought, well, how can we keep an element of that without being gross about it? And what I decided is that they've got this, it's all about symmetry. Like, we know that, like, humans are really into symmetrical faces and whatnot in the real world. And so the idea is, like, Lashuntas are just super symmetrical, and that at some like very basic level affects humans, where you're like, you just find them so compelling, because even if they're, you know, all not necessarily your type, you find them just really compelling because they've got these perfect faces.
They're well put together.
Well, and also another secret about the Lashunta and why we ended up going those two ways is because originally, you know, you'll notice in the basic races of Starfinder, elves and dwarves aren't there. Like, we decided to go all aliens and humans, and have, you know, the Pathfinder races are still around, but we didn't want them to be the main focus. But there were a lot of people saying, but we got to have dwarves, we got to have elves. And so the Lashunta was a chance for us to say, well, what is it about elves and dwarves that people really like? It's like, okay, well, if you like being very sort of willowy and very, you know, attractive and very educated and very, you know, diplomatic and all these different things, well, that's go this direction with the Lashunta. And if you like, you know, playing the burly dwarf, well, maybe you'll like playing the burly Lashunta and having a lot of those same traits. So it was kind of a chance to see, could we get those same players on board without just saying, you're an elf, you're a dwarf.
So what were some of the big obstacles in the development process? Like, when, the time,
the game as a whole?
Yeah.
Time was the biggest obstacle. And also, I mean, you're always, with any project like that, you're always going to have a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And so that was definitely, you know, my job as creative director was to sort of steer the ship and make sure that everybody felt heard, everybody got their input in, but at the end of the day, somebody had to make the call on what is Starfinder and what is not Starfinder. And Eric really invested me with that authority. And so that was kind of how that went. But for the most part, we were just racing against the clock, because what really, it was already a core rule book of the size of something Pathfinder was doing is just incredibly intensive, right? Like, you saw how long it took Pathfinder second edition to happen, and that was the second edition of an existing game. This was a new game, just as big but different, and so we had all that, plus starships, plus we knew we really wanted a bunch of setting material in there, because like, we all felt like that was really an important thing to selling the game, was to sell the setting, and then also we wanted to have more examples and more of an introduction, because all too often in role-playing games, it's really hard to learn how to play if you don't have somebody else teaching you how to play. And so for that first chapter, it was really crucial to us to have, you know, to take some lessons we'd learned from the beginner box and things like that, and try to make the game more accessible. So here we have, we need this to do all of these things, plus all these other things, and be more accessible. And so I did the spreadsheets, and it's like, that's a 1,000-page book. And so then I had to go through and figure out how to cut that down to something we could actually print that would be the size of the core rulebook from Pathfinder or smaller. And then we did, like, we really boiled it down, and because we didn't want to lose the options or the customization ability of Pathfinder, but we just had to choose sort of only the best. And I think in some ways the game really benefited from that, because, you know, in a lot of cases you were only getting the stuff that we truly couldn't bear to cut. Yeah. But of course it was also a huge challenge. And so generating all that material, especially, you know, writing it in-house, designing it in-house, it was grueling. It was the most challenging project of my entire career at Paizo.
Was it entirely written in-house?
It wasn't entirely. We had a couple of out-of-house freelancers, but really only a couple. Like, there might have been three, something like that. I can't remember right now, but for the most part, you know, it was all of us. We would work all day developing the stuff, and then we would go home and we would write the freelance to turn over the next day, right? You know, so really everybody was working around the clock. And we were pulling in resources from other departments. You know, in the beginning, I didn't even have a department. You know, I was creative director, but I didn't have people. So I was, you know, the design team was helping out and some of the developers and some of the editors. The, you know, the Star Chamber only formed partway through the process. It was really, it was crazy. Like, I mean, I'll tell you, we were up to the last minute. We totally revised the way ability scores work.
Yes.
Like a day before it went to approvals. Like we had, and that's a fundamental like building block of the game. But we had, you know, all designed something with the help of the design team that we thought, yeah, you know, we aren't super happy with it. Like, it seems a little bit overcomplicated, but it's fine. It's probably fine. Everybody seems fine with it. We had some play testing. Everybody was cool with it. And then someone, I think it was Amanda Hammond, said, you know what, let's put this in front of some people from the customer service department. Like, let's just get a bunch of folks who are not game designers and put the character building chapter in front of them and just see what they say. And then she came back, and after an hour of going through it, the players had rage quit. They said, not only do we not know how it works, but we hate this. And so we suddenly, and here we are, like, the book's about to ship. And so we, you know, we got everybody in the Star Chamber together and we all sat down and we said, you know, I said, we have to throw this out. Who's got other ideas? How are we going to do this? Yeah. Stephen Radney McFarland, who was on the design team at the time, pitched sort of a simplified alternative that I think he had actually advocated for originally, but it hadn't made it through the design team. And so he pitched, said, well, we could do this thing. And I said, great. So he explained his idea to me. And then I went and locked myself in my office for, you know, the rest of the day and just rewrote that chapter from scratch, like directly into InCopy, as I recall. And then, you know, we had some people read it. Does this look okay? Are people happy? And like the customer service team understood how it worked and was happy with it. And we went, great, good enough. But like, that's the level of, you know, major surgery we were doing up till the last minute.
Well, that's interesting. So I heard a version of that story from Chris Carey.
Sure, yeah.
But he said that it was he who rang the alarm bells.
Oh, I mean, maybe it was. He might have told Amanda, like, you know, this is, I can't deal with this. I mean, there was, to be clear, there were a lot of people making a lot of contributions. People think about the Starfinder team, but the truth is that it was all hands on deck at that point. And like, the Starfinder team was people dragooned in from different places, and it only got formalized after the game was sort of rolling.
I remember during the P2 crunch, we were pulling in people from every department to develop or edit elements of P2, even people in the Star Chamber.
Oh yeah.
We're editing pieces of P2.
And that's always how it was, you know, at least when I was at Paizo. Like, I know since I've left, they've staffed up considerably. Every time I go back, I go, oh my God, there's so many people here. So maybe we learned some lessons about what's actually possible to squeeze out of people. But
well, we I think I may have been one of the last people in that door before it
changed. Yeah.
Now there have been replacements since I joined the company. There haven't been any expansions. Well, I take that back. We just hired a full-time in-house artist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he can do redraws and he can do concept art, and it's a fantastic addition to our capacity.
See, that's funny, because I definitely remember the days when it was like, you know, we had not very many people. You know, you'd have a dozen people working on the words that go in the books, and then, you know, just Wes Schneider, who was the managing editor-in-chief, would be just sort of begging, like, please, we need just a little more budget. Like, look at these people haven't slept. You know, we have to do this.
When you were working on the game, was Pact Worlds already being planned? How far in advance?
The Pact Worlds book?
Yeah.
The Pact Worlds book was the last Pathfinder or last Starfinder project that I outlined. And actually that was one of the ones that really made me, because I had made my choice that privately, I had decided that I was going to leave. Like a long time before I actually did. Yeah. It was a long time coming. And so Pact Worlds actually, as one of my last projects in the last few weeks, really confirmed for me that I was making the right choice. Because one of the reasons why I left, like probably the big one, is that running things was amazing. Like being creative director on Starfinder was a huge rush. It was a great challenge. Like, I loved what we got to create, and I'm super proud of the game. But I just didn't have a lot of time to write. And I, like, writing had always been my first love. Yeah. And, you know, I was just turning down all these opportunities because I had this day job that was so, you know, consuming.
I've heard other people in your position say very similar things. It always reminds me of Captain Kirk. Like, it was a mistake to ever accept promotion, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, Wes and I always used to, when we were, you know, banging our heads against spreadsheets, trying to figure out schedules and how this was going to work. You know, we'd look at each other and say, you know, we got into this to write about dragons. Like, look at this desk. You would never know that we work at a dragon factory, because this could be anything. But outlining Pact Worlds was in many ways the perfect book for me. Okay. That was the book that, you know, had you just given that to me and let me write it cover to cover, as like sort of the expanded version of Distant Worlds, I would have just loved that. It would have been the greatest freelance assignment ever.
Yes.
And instead, because I was so busy, I was only able to write half a chapter. You know, like a couple thousand words out of this book where I'm like, everything in here is the greatest. You know, that's good because it meant a lot of different people got to get in on the project. Yeah. It just confirmed to me that, you know, what I really wanted to be doing is writing stuff. And whether that's, you know, now that I've gone full time, I can write comics and games, and I can do stuff for Pathfinder and Starfinder, and, you know, and Dungeons and Dragons. Like, I can write all this different stuff. And that's really nice. But I won't lie that I do sometimes miss, you know, being at the center of those things. Cause I grew up in Paizo, you know, that was, you know, I won't say my life's work cause I'm 35, but, you know, being there was the thing that I was doing. And I'm super proud of Pathfinder and Starfinder and still feel a lot of ownership over it. But of course I don't have any ownership over it. So these days I just sort of occasionally email or, you know, run into somebody and go, so what's going on with Starfinder these days? Like, what can you tell me?
You are still very much still involved in the development of the game, in the sense that you're working on projects for Starfinder and for Pathfinder.
Yeah, a few. But I make it very clear to people online that I'm not calling any shots. Right. Like, I am the lowest person in the hierarchy now.
Well, and many of those projects we can't talk about because
haven't
been released. But you're writing; you've been writing a lot of short fiction. Can we call it flash fiction if it's 1,000 words? Is that?
I think so. I think that's the cutoff.
You've been writing a bunch of flash fiction for us lately, doing iconic encounters and the stories with the various Starfinder and Pathfinder iconics, both, right?
Yeah. Then that was super fun because, of course, you know, I had run the web fiction back when we were still had a novel line for Pathfinder. We had also published short stories online, and that's how, you know, I would find new authors and stuff like that. Right. And then when the novel line went down or was put on hiatus, so did the web fiction. But Mark Moreland had been bringing it back in the last year or so as sort of a marketing thing, and came to see if I wanted to write some of these iconic encounters. So he would send me a picture of, you know, an illustration from one of the books, and then I would just have to write a story, you know, about a certain character from that illustration. And it was actually a great, you know, bit of nostalgia for me, because I don't know if folks remember, but it wasn't that long ago. All of the Pathfinder books, the rule books, the hardcovers, would have those chapter openers with a big image and then a little bit of fiction along the side. And over the years, I wrote like 95% of those. I think Jacobs and Wes might have done one of the books, and then I just wrote all of those. And it was really fun because for a long time it was I got to sort of do the first fiction featuring the iconic characters and really sort of introduce those personalities beyond just the Meet the Iconics write-ups. And so I really got to play with those characters and get to know them and introduce them to the audience, which was really fun.
Yeah, you were able to give them a voice.
Yeah, and so getting to then do that for, the Pathfinder, the P2 iconics, you know, for the same Pathfinder characters was a nice blast from the past. And then doing it for Starfinder, when that was the first, you know, some of the first fiction, really, we'd done with them. And for many of them, some of the first words they'd gotten since the Meet the Iconics posts. Yeah. It was really nice. It was really fun to go in there and be like, this is kind of my vision of what these people are like.
Now, I remember as the marketing push was hitting for Starfinder, like before the game had even come out.
Yeah.
There was a lot of new art coming out for it. People were starting to go crazy over it.
Yeah.
And the fan response was just, I mean, to me, from the outside, it seemed really surprisingly positive.
It was huge.
What was your reaction? And what was the reaction in the Paizo offices to the, as the fans were learning about the game for the first time?
I mean, it was amazing. It was really gratifying to start with, but also it gave everything more momentum. It was one of those things that made, you know, Eric and the rest of the, you know, executive team go, okay, this is not a risk. And in fact, we're going to need to ramp this stuff up, you know, be prepared to do more books.
Okay. So that's actually one of my questions, because did that decision to ramp up and do more books, when was that decision made? Because I'd always heard it was made at Gen Con when the book sold out.
I mean, maybe. There's these things don't really have a definite start point and end point. You know, somebody starts making the decision, and just because I think it's happening doesn't mean that Eric's convinced, and just because Eric thinks it's happening doesn't mean Lisa's authorized it. You know, like there's stuff like that. But I think we knew pretty early on with some of the press we were getting, you know, Jenny Bendel, the marketing director at the time, got us just some incredible interviews with, you know, like we had like 8 pages in like Game Informer and stuff like that. You know, it was bonkers. Yeah. And so we could tell that there was really excitement. And of course, Gen Con was the height of that, right? To see the book come out and sell out and everybody being super excited and just, you know, the staff walking down the line of people holding the books, just, you know, signing autographs like you do, you know, it was great. But especially for me, that was perfect because I went into there knowing like, this is the launch of the game. This is the biggest, you know, the biggest thing that I feel directly sort of responsible for. And also knowing privately, though nobody else knew, that this was going to be my swan song, that I was, you know, going to try and go out on a high note and, you know, pull a Calvin and Hobbes and just sort of sail off. And so it was very much a bittersweet, sort of beautiful thing to be like, this could be, who knows, this could be my last Gen Con, and to have it be such an amazing experience was deeply, deeply gratifying.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on all of the amazing work and the fantastic.
Thank you.
I have enormous fun playing in your sandbox, and it's a great privilege working on being in the development team, or as I sometimes have told my friends, being in the room where it happens.
Right.
It is an incredibly humbling privilege, knowing that this material we're making is going to be played and read and enjoyed by potentially millions of people is kind of overwhelming.
Right.
It's
crazy. And I feel like, you know, we had been through that before with Pathfinder. So some of us who had been around a long time had been there, but also like, you never know if lightning is going to strike twice, right? Like the assumption is that probably it won't, because that's the only safe assumption.
That's right.
So you're always just, you know, it's at some level you're saying, okay, well, we got to do X. We got to be good enough to keep the lights on. But also I feel like one of the things that was really important to the creation of Starfinder and to Pathfinder that's part of the success is we were writing for each other. And I think that that's one of the things that is the biggest, sometimes the biggest factor in whether a game product works or not. Like the stuff that we worked on at Paizo over all the years that I was there, it was the books that we in-house loved, you know, or the books that like even just one person was super into.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that the fans would get into, whether that was, you know, Wes with the Books of the Damned, or, you know, Jacob's doing, you know, stuff with sort of, you know, Sandpoint and like Numeria and all these different things that he was really passionate about. You know, it was when we were writing to sort of have fun and appeal to each other's tastes. And just to kind of say like, you know, oh man, watch this, you know, you're going to love this. I always say that I spent the first couple years at Paizo just learning what was cool. Just listening to Eric and Jacobs and Wes and Bullman and everybody else, and just trying to figure out what does everybody like? Like, what are these, what are all the different tastes out there and which one of those are compatible with mine? And, you know, that Starfinder started there, honestly. Like, you can trace Starfinder all the way back to Pathfinder Adventure Path number 3. Like the third volume. Have you already heard this story?
No, I haven't. Please, we'll finish with this. Please.
Yeah, you can trace it all the way back, because in Pathfinder Adventure Path, book 3, before we had a Pathfinder role playing game when it was still third edition, we ran Gazetteer of Verusia, and so I got to write the Gazetteer of Verusia. James Jacobs had come up with Verusia and drawn out the map, but he only had a couple of, you know, he had Sandpoint and Magnemar and a couple of dots on there. And then, you know, he handed that over and I got to just fill in the rest.
Right.
And it was amazing fun. It was still one of my favorite, you know, writing assignments of all time. And then at the end, I turn it in and I'm really excited. And he and Wes came and sat me down and said, "All right, Sutter, this is good. We like this, but you can't have a space elevator in Verusia," because that was, I think it was the Spire of Lemris, but like I had put a space elevator right in the middle of it and said, you know, why not? We can do whatever. They said, this is a fantasy game. You need to like slow your roll a little bit. But that DNA never really left, and there were always sort of hints dropped throughout, you know, by me and by other people, that there was this certain science fantasy universe beyond just Pathfinder. And so I think it was always there. So it was a lot of fun to be able to finally realize it.
Well, James Sutter, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a real pleasure. And I hope that we see you around the offices more, and maybe we'd be able to have you back on the show again to talk about some of your other projects.
I would love to come back on.
All right. Thanks, folks. And stay tuned for our next episode.
Thank you.